Matthew chapter 24, Matthew chapter 24. I want to pick up at verse 3. There was a subject in that verse we were looking at when we ended. I mentioned some Old Testament passages for you. Don't know if you had time to write them down or not, but I wanted to look them up with you tonight because this little word translated in the passage is interesting, not only in this verse, but in the context of the subject under consideration. Let's just begin our reading at verse 1. Everyone's familiar that this is Jesus as he speaks about the destruction of Jerusalem. Matthew 24 and in verse 1 in the New King James Version, "Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, 'Do you not see all of these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down.' Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, 'We learn from Mark's account that it was Peter, James, and John, and Andrew who came.'" And Jesus speaks directly to them on this occasion, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" I suggested that you consider Luke's account in Luke 21 in regard to the questions that are asked here, and Mark's account as well. In those two accounts, they only list two questions. Here, it seems as though three questions are indicated. I take the position that there's only two questions. That the last question that is here in Matthew's account, even though it seems to have two parts, it actually speaks of just one question with two things taking place, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age. Of course, many people take the coming under consideration as the second coming of Christ here, and they'll associate that, of course, with the context here. But I take the coming here that has reference and in connection with the sign. What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? So what will be the sign of your coming? If the coming there is the second coming of Christ, and there are a lot of people who take that's what's under consideration, then we'll have to find a sign somewhere in the New Testament that Christ is coming again. But we know Christ, when he comes, is going to come as a thief in the night in his second coming. A thief is not going to give you a sign or an indication that he's coming. Remember, we defined this word sign last Wednesday evening. It's that which points towards something. And it's a Greek word that has reference to it pointing towards something. And I mentioned John 20 in verse 30 and 31 about the signs that Jesus performed that John recorded. Those seven signs, they pointed to the fact that he was deity, the Son of God. And so John recorded those seven signs to cause people to believe. They would see those signs, hear about those signs, recognize those signs, that those signs could have been done by no one but deity, the Son of God. And so they pointed toward him as being the Son of God. The sign that is under consideration here is connected with the first question: when will these things be? When? That interrogative "when" here, adverb in the Greek, is a time reference. They're asking for a time. When's these things going to take place? What things? Well, the destruction of the temple that he's just mentioned, the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. That's what they're asking. Of course, he's not going to tell them when. He's not going to give them a date because the date is not known. The time is not known. That is the specific day, the specific hour. Jesus can't give them that because he does not know that. Only the Father in heaven knows that. As a matter of fact, the things that transpire during this particular period of time is kind of like spring or summer to us. You know, what day does spring come? Well, we have one day marked on our calendar when it says spring comes. But we know that that's not when spring comes. Spring comes through a process of time, through a process of days. It doesn't just happen just one day or one hour. And that's the way these things. So Jesus is not going to give them a specific time in regard to a day or an hour when it's going to happen. But yet, that's the first question they ask. And the sign has to do with that. When are these things going to take place? What's going to be the sign that these things are going to be destroyed? And of course, the destruction of the city of Jerusalem, the destruction of the nation of Israel by the Romans in 70 AD is the end of the age. The age here, Ion in the Greek, has reference not to the end of the world as we know it when Christ comes again and this world will be destroyed, but it has reference to the Jewish age, this particular time period in history. We might say it has reference to the generation then living, because Jesus says these things will come upon this generation. And so I wanted to go back and look with you now at this little word "in" here. Now, we see "in" mentioned other times in this particular chapter, but it's a different word. It's a different word. The word that is translated "in" here, I mentioned last Wednesday evening, is a word that is translated in the Septuagint version, that's the Greek translation of the Old Testament scriptures, in the book of Daniel and in other places, in reference to the final end, the final end of the nation of Israel. Look with me in Jeremiah, if you will, Jeremiah 4 and in verse 27. Jeremiah 4 and verse 27, you're familiar with Jeremiah. Jeremiah, remember, writes about the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians. And so, of course, the city will be destroyed. They'll be taken away into Babylonian captivity. So we're looking at Jeremiah 4, and in verse 27, we're going to see where the same Greek word is used. When I say the Septuagint version was a Greek translation of the Old Testament scriptures. So when 70 Jewish scholars translated that Hebrew scriptures, they used the same word that is used here in Matthew 24 and in verse 3 to describe the utter end of the nation of Israel. Jeremiah 4 and verse 27. For thus says the Lord, the whole land shall be desolate. Speaking about the destruction during the time of the Babylonians. Yet I will not make a full end. There's our word. I'll not make a full end. That is, he'll not destroy them totally and utterly and completely. Their end will not be final at that particular period of time. Now then, turn with me over to the book of Daniel, where we see the word used again. Daniel, and of course, Daniel prophesies of this particular time period, and of course, Jesus is going to mention something that Daniel mentions, and perhaps we'll get to it in our study tonight. But we're looking in Daniel 12 and verse 4. But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. There's our word, the final and full end, complete end of the nation of Israel. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. Jumping down in the context of verse 8, Daniel 12, 8 and 9. Although I heard, I did not understand. Then I said, my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? There's the word again. What shall be the end of these things? The final end, the complete end, full end. Again in verse 9, and he said, go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Till the time of the end, till the time of the complete end of the nation of Israel. And that's what's under consideration there in that particular chapter, and that's what's under consideration here. So what will be the sign of your coming and of the end, the final end, the complete end of this age? Now some, as I mentioned, take that word translated age there, world, in the King James Version, and they think it means the final or complete end of the world, you see.
That's what I've always thought.
Well, I'll not argue with you about it, but I will suggest to you, I think it has reference to the final end of the Jewish nation, just as Daniel is prophesying. Because remember we read last week in Luke's account that that during this particular time period, all that is written will be fulfilled. All that is written concerning Jerusalem and Israel will be fulfilled in these days.
In verse 36, Jesus answered the second part of their question.
Yeah.
That's called, most Bible translators have called this the transition verse of the whole Bible. It says, but of that day and hour.
Yeah.
No one knows. What's that talking about?
Well, we'll get to that. I don't take the traditional view of that, but we'll get to that. We'll get to that. Just follow my arguments through, and when we get to it, see what you think. If I change your mind, fine. If I don't, that's fine as well. There are many in the brotherhood who have different views regarding this chapter. I'm one of those. It's kind of different from what we might call a traditional view. But yet there are still others that have the same view that I have. As we go back and looked at Luke's account and Mark's account, we clearly see there's only two questions. But then when we come to Matthew's account, it seems to indicate there's three questions, but there's not. As a matter of fact, there's only one definite article in that last question, the sign of your coming and of the end of age. And so because there's only one definite article, it seems to indicate that there's really only one question. His coming is connected with the sign. The coming under consideration is not the coming at the end of the world, but if we just assume that it's the coming of the end of the world, then are we going to take every time he mentions coming here as the coming at the end of the world? Or is he coming in judgment on the city of Jerusalem? I want to suggest to you that he's coming in judgment on the city of Jerusalem. Now, some believe that it's his second coming. But let's move on in the context, and then perhaps we can answer some more questions, or some more questions will be posed. Verse 4, and Jesus answered and said to them, that is to the ones to whom he's speaking, directly to the apostles, take heed that no one deceives you, leads you astray, causes you to be misled. Now, get this. Jesus is already concerned about them being misled, about them being mistaken about something, because he's just talked about his coming. And so, lest they get the idea that he's coming in a physical sense, he begins to explain. Verse 4 again. Take heed that no one deceive you. Why? For, there's that little Greek conjunction, gives a reason for that statement. For many will come in my name. Many will come in my name. Many will come taking my name, taking my title, saying I am the Christ, I am the Messiah, and will deceive, mislead, cause many people to be mistaken. So, no doubt Jesus thought, well, they're going to think when I speak about my coming, they're going to think that I'm coming and they're going to be able to see me. Well, many people, there were many false Christs during this time. People would come, just as they are now. Some arise from time to time saying, I'm the Messiah. During this particular period of time, there would be false Christs arise. There'd be those who would come who would say, I am the Messiah. Why would people be coming and saying that? Because the Old Testament scriptures prophesied of a Messiah who was going to come. But guess what? He's already come. And so he's going to have to persuade the disciples here that, hey, I'm not coming. I'm already here. I'm not coming. And when they say, look, the Christ, don't go out looking for him because he's already come, as you think, as you talk about coming.
For miracles and raise the dead. I mean, what else did they want?
Right. And they had identified him as the Christ before. But of course, they didn't understand all of this. They had not comprehended all of this. You know, when he ascends to the Father's right hand, they're still asking him, is he going to restore the kingdom of God at that particular time? They're still thinking the kingdom of God is something physical and not the spiritual kingdom. And so they're just confused. So take heed that no one deceive you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. Verse 6. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you do not be troubled when they hear of wars and rumors of wars. Now, during this particular period of time, there was wars and rumors of wars taking place. You might say the Jews were fighting among themselves, and there was also going to be, during this particular period of time, the Romans were going to be undergoing what we might call civil wars within the Roman Empire. Because when Nero kills himself in 68 AD, one king right after another arises to power, three kings in a row. How did they rise to power and then someone else come? Because they were killed. Vespasian has to leave the battlefield and go to Rome and take the throne. Because there's wars and rumors of wars. There's a lot of wars going on, a lot of fighting going on during this particular period of time. Even before the siege was laid to the city of Jerusalem in 66 AD. We don't read about this in the scripture, but we read about it from historians. In 66 AD, there was many Jews killed in the city of Jerusalem. Many Jews were killed in the city of Jerusalem. By whom? By the Romans. During this particular period of time, there was a faction among the Jews who sided with Rome and those who sided against Rome. They didn't want Rome ruling and reigning over them. They didn't want a Roman emperor or king ruling and reigning over them. And as a matter of fact, taxation had gotten out of hand. And even though the Roman authorities had given the tax collectors the right to collect taxes, of course, we know the reputation that tax collectors had because they were ripping people off. They were taxing them more than what was required. And so the Jewish people just were not setting back taking this. So there was uprisings from time to time between the Jews and the Romans. And in 66 AD, after that was, I think it was in 66 when Herod plundered the temple in the city of Jerusalem. And the Jews rose up against them so bad that Cestius Gallus, a Roman governor out of Syria, had to come with a Roman force and put down the uprising against the Jews. And this was kind of the beginning point of the Roman and Jewish wars in 66 AD. And when Cestius Gallus went back towards Syria, the Jews gathered themselves together and went after them and destroyed a great number of them. And so during this particular period of time, there'd be wars and rumors of wars. So don't be perturbed with these. Don't be afraid of these. Don't let these things trouble you. See that you are not troubled, for all of these things, note this, all of these things must come to pass. All of these things must. It's a necessity. It's an inevitability that these things must come to pass. These things must happen. Why must they happen? Because it's the beginning of the Roman and Jewish wars. It's the beginning of the end, you might say. But the end is not yet. Now here the word translated end is different. But in the context, let me ask you, what do you suppose the end has reference to? Now if we take the end in verse 3 to be the end of the world, he's saying, but the end of the world is not yet. Is that what he's saying? But in the context, that's not really what's under consideration. But the end is not yet. They ask him, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Now, he's going to give them a sign of his coming. He's going to mention it later on in the context. But that's not the end of the world, because since that sign was given and he came according to that sign, the world continues. But the end is not yet. I want to suggest to you that even though it's a different word, in the Greek, the word end here means termination or conclusion. The end or termination of what has been determined. And that which is determined by the context here. And I want to suggest to you it's the end of the nation of Israel. End of the city of Jerusalem and the temple. Because that's what Jesus said was going to happen, and that's what they ask him a question about. So that's the end under consideration, and it's going to be mentioned more. But the end is not yet. These things must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. What do we have? We have what was mentioned earlier, wars and rumors of wars. Another way of saying nation will rise up, that is, rise up against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famine and pestilence and earthquakes in various places. What comes with war? We're not familiar with that because we've not lived through one in our own land. But you know what comes through war, especially during this time? Famine comes. All you got to do is go back and read in Jeremiah about the destruction of Jerusalem. The famine was so bad, what did they do when the Babylonians laid siege to the city of Jerusalem?
They ate their own children.
And it's going to be that bad here. And Josephus writes about it in his historical account. I mentioned Josephus from time to time. You might not know who he is. Josephus is a Jewish historian. Jewish historian. As a matter of fact, he came from a priestly family. And he fought against the Romans in the Galilean campaign.
He's a very credible writer.
He was. And he was, after he was defeated by Vespasian in the Galilean campaign, Vespasian took him for his slave and his translator. And when Jerusalem was destroyed, he was there. And he recorded the history of the Jews and the destruction of Jerusalem. Many people don't put much account in what he has to say. Some thinks he's built it up and it's not truthful, but he's one historian out of more. There's Roman historians that wrote about the same thing. But Josephus is a credible historian, and I think we can, even if he inflates, like he calculated over 1 million Jews were killed in the city of Jerusalem. Even if he overcalculated that, just think about it by half. We're talking about 500,000 Jews were killed in Jerusalem. But even if it's 300,000, we get upset today when there's 170,000 killed by coronavirus. We can't imagine being in a city where 500,000 people or 300,000 or 200,000 are killed in war. But that's what happens. And during the time of war, there's great famine. There's pestilence. That is, there's plagues. There's disease breaks out. Why? Because the source of water. You can't bathe. As a matter of fact, during war, you don't use water for bathing. You use water for survival. And because you don't use it for bathing, then all kind of disease breaks out. And just think about being in a city during this particular time without modern conveniences. Modern bathrooms. Where would the waste from the city go? It'd just pile up in the city. I'm talking about dead bodies, bodies of animals, human waste. You can imagine the pestilence, the plague, the disease that comes from all of that. And then he says earthquakes in various places, different places. All of these are the beginnings of sorrow. Note that. All of these are the beginnings of sorrow. The beginnings of sorrow to the end of the world? No. The beginning of sorrow for these people. Literally, the phrase in the English Standard Version, as well as the New American Standard Bible in English and the New International Version, literally birth pains. Birth pains. So he announces the disaster here that is to fall upon Jerusalem as the beginning of birth pains, great labor pains. I wonder where he gets that idea. Does anyone have any idea where he gets that idea? Jeremiah 4 and in verse 31. Jeremiah 4 and in verse 31. In regard to the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians, same phrase used. Why wouldn't it be used here? Describes the same thing taking place. The beginning of sorrows. The beginning of birth pains. Remember, it's just the beginning. Why? Because the end is not yet here. It's not yet come. All of these are the beginning of sorrows. Verse 9. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. I want you to take your pencil and circle that little word in, then, excuse me, that little adverb. I believe it's important. As a matter of fact, that little adverb is used by Matthew 90 times in the New Testament. Matthew uses that little adverb then more times than Mark and Luke and John put together. In our context, he's going to use it several times. Note in verse 9 it's used, verse 10 it's used, verse 14 it's used, verse 16 it's used, verse 21, verse 23, verse 30 it's used twice. Then again in verse 40. And we're going to see that it's going to be used several times. So 9 times in chapter 24, 8 times in chapter 25. This little adverb is a point of time in regard to other events. It's used in two primary ways in the New Testament. It has the simple meaning of then, at that time, usually with a past meaning, but sometimes with a future connotation. And the second way it is used is it's used simply as a consecutive conjunction that indicates the general period in which events occurred without reference to a specific time or sequence. So one way in which it is used, then, at that time, so it has reference to a time or perhaps a sequence of things that are taking place. I want to suggest to you that's primarily the way it's used in this context. It is also used in this context, I believe, in the second way, simply as indicating the general period in which events occurred without reference to particular time, but primarily it has reference to time here. Now, why would I say that? Because remember the question they asked, when will these things be? Because it's used in reference to time. So he's going to use then several times. So note this, these are the beginning of sorrows. Of course, the end is not yet. Then they will deliver you up. So these things that he has mentioned before, these are just the beginnings of the afflictions and tribulations and sorrows and misery that's going to come during this particular period. And then this is going to happen in the process of time, in the process of these events. Then, at this time, you might say, then they will deliver you up to tribulation. King James Version says affliction. Translated tribulation in verse 21 and 29 as well. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. Who's he speaking to? The apostles. You want to know what happened to the apostles? You know, man says we don't know what happened to the apostles, and we really don't know. But Jesus just told Peter, James, and John, and Andrew, they're going to be delivered up and killed. That phrase, delivered up, means turned over, hand over to authorities to stand trial or be put to death, as Jesus was delivered up, turned over, or hand over by Judas to the authorities. Same word. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. And you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. You apostles are going to be hated by all nations. You're not going to be hated by the Jews only, but you're going to be hated by the Gentiles as well for my name's sake. That is, because of me. Now, why would they be hated? Because they're preaching the gospel. Not only did unbelieving Jews not like it, and they began from the first day that Jesus appeared on the scene, even before he appeared, when John the Baptizer appeared. The unbelieving Jews was there, antagonizing, creating enmity and hatred with the other unbelieving Jews against Jesus and against all he would teach. And we continued to see it. until finally they even turn the Gentiles against them. And so you'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended. Many will be offended. That little word offended there is that word we studied not long ago. Simply means to cause a person to sin. That is, many will be offended. They'll have distrust. They'll not obey. They'll be caused to fall away. Will betray one another. Then that word betray is the same Greek word translated deliver up in verse 9. Will betray one another. That is, they'll deliver one another up. Do we have any occasion of that in the New Testament? Were any unbelieving Jews delivered up? Others turned them over to the authorities to be persecuted and put to death? We do, don't we? Saul of Tarsus did it. An unbelieving Jew who turned his own kinsmen, his own fellow Jews, over to the authorities to be put to death. Then many will be offended. So even after the apostles come on the scene, many are going to be offended. They're going to be caused to sin. They're going to be caused to fall away. I think the New International Version renders it like that. Many will be caused to fall away. Many will betray one another. That is, they'll betray one another. They'll turn against one another. And they will hate one another. They'll show their hatred, enmity, and contempt for one another. Why? Because these times are going to be hard. They're going to be difficult. You talk about extreme conditions. I'm sure during some of our world wars, there were perhaps, of course not in our own country, but in the countries in which the wars was taking place, I'm sure people of own family would turn over others. If you've read any Jewish history of the Holocaust and stuff, you know that some Jews, they turned their family members in. They got loaded on trains and sent off to places like Dachau and other places like that, stripped naked and sent into the showers, but they appeared to be showers, but it was gas rooms. Instead of water coming out the spigots, gas came out. They were killed. I'm sure just as during times of that, it was during times of this occasion as well when things were just like that were taking place. We see it with Saul of Tarsus and others. Verse 11, then many false prophets will arise and deceive many. There's that word we saw earlier. Take heed that no one deceive you in verse 4. And many will be deceived in verse 5. Many false prophets will arise and deceive many. Remember, we're studying in 1 John. And John tells the people to whom he's writing to, it is the last hour. And many false prophets are in the world. Many antichrists are present. I suggested to you that John wrote 64 or 65 A.D. Many false prophets. What's a false prophet? He's one who assumes the position of a prophet, declares himself to be a prophet, a spokesman for God. But he's a false prophet because he lies, tells falsehoods. He's not really a prophet. He just claims to be a prophet. So all that he would speak is simply lies. And many false prophets will arise. That is, they'll come on the scene and they'll deceive many. Who are they going to deceive? A false prophet? Is he going to deceive a Jew who's involved in Judaism? He's going to deceive Christians. That's who they're going to deceive. Backed in the context, take heed that no one deceive you, apostles. Verse 5, and many will be deceived. Many Christians are going to be deceived. Christ has already come, but don't believe the false prophets. Don't believe it when they say the Christ is in the desert or the Christ is over here, because he's already come. His coming under consideration here is a coming in judgment. Then many false prophets will arise and deceive many. Verse 12, and because lawlessness will abound, lawlessness will increase. Lawlessness here. King James Version uses the word iniquity, but it's the word most often translated lawlessness. It's not the absence of law, it's the violation of law. And because lawlessness will abound, Lawlessness here has to do with, usually in the New Testament, it has to do with the violation of God's law. No doubt that could be under consideration here, but during this particular period of time, there would be violation of human law as well. Just as they are in some of our cities today, there's anarchy. And so there's violation of all kind of law. There's violation of God's law and violation of man's law. If you could think about living in a city that's in anarchy today, in the city of Jerusalem, that's the way it was. Because in the city of Jerusalem, there were warring factions within the city itself. As a matter of fact, some believe that the Jews killed more of their own people in the city than the Romans did, because there was about three warring factions within the city after the siege had actually been laid to it. And so they were killing one another off. And because lawlessness will abound during this period of time, note this, the love of many will grow cold. The love of many. Love here is agape love. It's the highest form of love. It's kindness, goodwill, benevolence. It is seeking the greatest good, not only for your fellow man, but expressing that same goodwill and benevolence toward God. The love of many, note this, will grow cold. Wax cold, the King James Version says. That old English word simply means become cold. Now, the idea is not that their love will begin to weaken. No, the idea is that the love will be absent. It will be cold, because only one with no love for his fellow man could do what is mentioned in the previous verses. Will betray one another and hate one another. Only one absent of love could turn his own brother or sister, or mother or father over to the authorities to be put to death. That's a total absence of love. As a matter of fact, it's like the mother who aborts her baby, an absence of parental love. It's not a weakening of love, it's a cold love. There's no love at all. The love of many will grow cold, not grow, become. That's what that Greek word wax and the old English word means, become cold. Verse 13. Note this, but he who endures, he who perseveres, he who holds out, he who bears up to the end shall be saved. Now there are some who take the word saved here to be saved physically. If they persevere and hold out to the end, they'll be saved physically. But that can't be the idea that's under consideration, because he's just told some of the apostles, you're going to be killed. During this particular time period, you're going to be killed. Isn't that what he said? Isn't that what he told Peter, James, John, and Andrew? Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. Either Jesus lied, and they were not killed, and their lives were saved to the end. Well, no. Physical salvation is not under consideration. Spiritual salvation is. Even in the face of trying times like this, some of them would be put to death. But as Jesus spoke to the church at Smyrna, Revelation 2 and verse 10, be faithful unto death, and I'll give you the crown of life. Be faithful unto death, unto the point of being put to death. So if you endure, if you persevere, if you hold out, if you bear up until the end, until the end of the world? No. Until the end of this. If you keep your faith through all of this and still lose your life, you'll be saved. You'll be saved spiritually. That's the point he's making. And the end is not the end of the world, because we don't live to the end of the world. He who endures to the end shall be saved. So is the end here the end of the world? He who endures, we got to persevere and hold out to the end of the world, and then we'll be saved. No.
Just talking back to the end of our lives. The end of our life?
Possible. I think the end under consideration is the same end that's already been mentioned twice. if you hold out to the end, if you persevere to the end. It would be true if we persevere to the end of life. But based on Revelation 2 and in verse 10, be faithful unto death. The death there is physical death. That is the taking of your life. Be faithful and trustworthy and dependable, even if you're put to death, because some are going to betray you. Some of you are going to be killed. Be faithful unto it. You'll be saved. Now, I missed it, but I wanted you to see it. In verse 9, I mentioned that little adverb, then. Well, notice it's mentioned again in verse 10, then. We might say then, after that, or then at that time, many will be offended. And then in verse 11 again, then at that time, many false prophets will arise. And so we're going to see it continue through the context here. But I just want us to be aware of that, because it's going to be very important when we get on down in the context. All right, we're out of time. We'll pick up here at Matthew 24 and verse 14 next Wednesday evening. Thank you very much for your kind attention.